Lecture 6, The Trojan War and Homeric Warfare.
Thus far, we have concerned ourselves with the earliest civilizations in the Near East and Egypt. Now we turn, for the first time, westward, or at least partly westward, to the coast of Asia Minor. The Trojan War was the foundational motif of Greek civilization, providing, as it did, the dramatic backdrop for the two poems by Homer, the Iliad and the Odyssey. Although there was a tradition independent of Homer about the Trojan War and the heroes who actually fought in it, these two poems, especially the Iliad, which takes place entirely at Troy, represent our fullest and richest representations of the event. As such, we must proceed our consideration of the Trojan War with an appreciation of what exactly we are dealing with in these two fabulous works of literature. For the past 200 years, practically every aspect of the Homeric poems has generated scholarly controversy. Whether Homer ever existed at all as an individual, whether the poems show the imprint of a single talent, whether they are the work of one man, two men, or a sequence of authors working in different times and places, when and where the poems took the form they currently have, on and on it goes. Most of these Homeric controversies are well beyond the scope of this course, but two issues are paramount for the possibility of using the poems as an historical source. First, do the poems enshrine an historical reality, or realities? And second, if so, what is the chronological point of reference for that reality, or realities? We will consider each in turn. Most today would accept that the Homeric epics were written down between 750 and 700 BC, but they self-consciously refer to a bygone age of heroes when men were bigger, stronger, and communed freely with the gods. In this sense, the poems are overtly fictive. But is the heroic world a complete fantasy, or does an historical reality inform it? Are we dealing perhaps with a garbled memory of a real past overlaid with fantastical elements? And if so, how do we disentangle the memory from the fantasy? There are no ready responses to these questions, and much depends on what views one holds on the even more basic questions about Homer and the Homeric corpus just mentioned. A broad consensus, however, exists on the following issues. Following the work of Harvard professors Milman, Parry, and Albert Lord in the mid-20th century, it is all but universally accepted that the poems as we have them are a product of an oral epic tradition passed down the ages before Homer from bard to bard. Epic was a performative medium sung with musical accompaniment before an audience. The tradition was not enshrined in a fixed text, rather it was a flexible and manageable collection of narrative modules that could be creatively combined as the circumstances of the performance required. The Iliad, as we have it, is really a collation and amalgam of modules revolving around different heroes, probably initially performed separately, but here retold under the umbrella of an overarching story about the anger of Achilles and its consequences outside Troy. The formulaic nature of oral epic poetry, with its rhythmic meter and fixed epithets, lines, and even whole passages, meant that as the tales were sung and resung down the generations before Homer, bits and pieces were added or dropped out as needs be. So the poems do not refer to a particular time and place, but represent a palimpsest of eras and settings, freely mixed and mingled by the requirements of the genre to evoke the quasi-mythical world of the heroes. This world was real and familiar to an ancient Greek audience on one level, but clearly fantastical and fictional on another. Like prehistoric insects caught and encased in once fluid amber, slices of ancient reality could become embedded in the epic tradition as it passed by. These slices would likely pertain to things rather than to social customs or political practices, because to keep the tradition lively and relevant, the latter needed constant upgrading to remain germane to each generation's audience, while unfamiliar objects only added colour to the exotic world of the heroes. And this is precisely what many analysts see in the poems, a largely 8th century social and cultural world of Homer's day, studded with bits of earlier, even Bronze Age material culture. Thus, the heroes all use bronze weapons, even though in Homer's day, iron weaponry was the norm. In one passage, Homer describes a curious helmet made from boar's tusks sewn onto a felt cap. Helmets just like this are archaeologically attested down to the end of the Bronze Age, around 1100 BC, but not afterwards. Homer's audience did not use them and probably did not know of them. Likewise, a minor hero in the Iliad uses a huge shield that reaches down to his ankles and can be slung over his shoulder as he runs away. The Trojan champion Hector kills this hero when he trips over his shield and falls over, so that the shield is a key element in his death scene. Such shields are known from Greece, but only up to about the 15th century BC. So not only was the so-called Tower Shield alien to Homer's audience, it would have been alien even to later Bronze Age audiences. And it is important to note that the tradition preserves not just the appearance of the shield, but how it was used as well. So some items in the hero's world appear to have solid historical analogues in ages long before Homer, and note, they are all objects. The process of oral transmission possibly reaches back from the time of final composition, or we'll say around 700 BC, back into the Mycenaean period of the Greek Bronze Age, which stretched roughly from 1600 to 1100 BC. Now, what all this might mean, or what it might say or might not say about the historicity of the Trojan War, which is traditionally dated to 1183 BC, remains moot. But confronting these interpretive issues in Homer must be the starting point of any analysis. Time now to see what non-Homeric sources may contribute to the issue. First, archaeology. Troy, also known as Ilium, was unearthed in 1870 by Heinrich Schliemann at Hisarlik in northwestern Turkey, and has been explored in dozens of excavation campaigns ever since. The site has yielded a complex archaeological history with at least 9 distinct occupation levels going back before 3000 BC. This was clearly a popular spot for settlement in ancient times. There are 2 candidates for the Troy of King Priam and the Trojan War. Troy 6, with a broad boulevard and massive walls, towers and gates, but of a date around 1250 BC, a little too early to fit the Trojan War. And Troy 7a, a shadow of Troy 6's former glory, but better fitted to the date of the supposed war. The site has provided ammunition for those who support or deny the reality of the war itself. Supporters point to the fact that archaeology has confirmed the existence of a place formerly considered purely legendary. It occupied a very advantageous location. It was rich and powerful and well-walled, as one Homeric epithet puts it, with massive gates and towers of the highest quality construction. Skeptics point to many things, not least the site's small size. At about 20,000 square meters, this is hardly the vast city of towering monuments and expansive palaces described in Homer. As one German scholar of ancient cities has put it, Troy 6 and 7a, which might be considered a chronological match for Homer's Troy, were wretched little settlements which could make no serious claim to the title of city. If there ever was a war over this insignificant place, it must have been a pretty minor tussle, hardly the stuff of epic tradition. It is precisely about the issue of scale that recent excavations by Manfred Korfmann, starting in 1988 and still ongoing, have caused such a firestorm. Korfmann has found evidence that the compact citadel tourists visit today was only the acropolis of a much larger city that ranged widely over the plain around it, enclosing perhaps 200,000 square meters, that is, 10 times larger than previously thought. This larger Troy would have been much more worthy of a serious war, as it was probably a major regional power that controlled key trade routes and access to the Anatolian plateau, home of the powerful Hittite Empire. Furthermore, the evidence has been interpreted to suggest that this greater Troy, as you might call it, had connections to the Hittites, led a league of local states, and was destroyed violently, possibly in the trade war with the Greeks. A new Trojan War exploded over these claims when an ancient historian and colleague of Korfmann's at Tübingen University in Germany, Frank Kolb, the very man who had dubbed Troy 6 and 7 wretched little settlements, accused Korfmann of fantasizing in print. The dispute became so vicious and heated that it even made it into the pages of the New York Times, a rarity for any academic spiff, never mind one taking place in Germany. Kolb's objections center on 2 issues. First, evidence that Troy was a trade hub at the time of the Trojan War is virtually non-existent. Indeed, evidence for major commercial activity in the Bronze Age Aegean and the Black Sea area as a whole is very weak, and virtually nothing from these regions has been found at the site of Troy itself. Second, Kolb maintains that Korfmann's claims for a greater Troy are overblown and don't bear close scrutiny. This debate aside, the fundamental truth is that the physical remains at Troy and elsewhere, while suggestive, have failed to demonstrate categorically the reality of the Trojan War. For instance, pottery made by Bronze Age Greeks, termed Mycenaeans by modern scholars, has been found all along the western Turkish coast and at Troy itself. Further, tablets from the Greek mainland inscribed with the Mycenaean script make mention of female workers marked as coming from various western Turkish locations. The connections between Mycenaean Greece and the region around Troy are therefore not in doubt, but the material record would suggest that those connections were not terribly strong. 99% of all pottery found at Troy 6 and Troy 7 is of local style and manufacture. So while such finds may be illuminative of its context, they do not prove that the Trojan War itself actually happened. At the site, Troy 6 and Troy 7a seem to have suffered violent destruction. There is evidence of burning and tumbled walls. In particular, Troy 7a features many small dwellings packed up against the citadel's walls and much space devoted to storage. An arrowhead of Mycenaean type was found in one of its streets. Is this evidence for people coming inside the walls to escape besiegers? And does the arrowhead point to the Greek identity of those besiegers? Possibly. But a single arrowhead is a slim basis indeed on which to posit the occurrence of a whole war, and an earthquake can just as easily account for the tumbled walls and fires. Famine-ravaged rustics could have packed into Troy 7a to receive sustenance from the royal storerooms. And a single arrowhead could drop into a Trojan street as easily from a Greek traveller's bag as from a Greek besieger's bow. All in all, given the solid evidence drawn from other ancient siege sites, and we can compare here the evidence found at Lachish in Israel, which we'll be discussing in Lecture 8, there is much that is lacking at Troy by way of hard evidence for a war, let alone an epoch-making conflict of the sort Homer seems to commemorate. In my view, the deeper issue is this. Short of weapons and armour inscribed with Achilles was here or I belong to Hector, what could archaeology possibly unearth that would verify the stories told about the Trojan War? Paris taking Helen from Sparta, the expedition to Troy, Achilles' fight with Agamemnon, the deaths of Patroclus or Hector, or the Trojan horse. These motifs surely exist wholly in the realm of legend, and no amount of physical evidence will ever confirm them. We just have to accept that. So there were high hopes when a different line of inquiry was initiated by the discovery of the Hittite Empire in Anatolia in the 19th century. Extensive archives were found, and study of them opened up some intriguing possibilities. Now, we have already met the Hittites as they challenged Ramesses the Great for control of Syria-Palestine at the Battle of Kadesh in the 13th century BC. At this time, they were the lords of Asia Minor. Their records, uncovered and read, make mention of places called Willusa and Truisa to the west, the former ruled by a king named Alexandu, and people dubbed Ahiyawa also lay to the west. Many have heard in these appellations echoes of Greek names for Troy. Ilios, for instance, which would have been pronounced Willios in pre-Homeric Greek for the Hittite term Willusa, or Troia for the Hittite term Truisa, and Alexandu echoes Alexandros, an alternate name in Homer for Paris, prince of Troy. And Ahiyawa sounds like one of Homer's words for the Greeks at Troy, Acheoi. Likewise, contemporary Egyptian records mention Danaia, or these the Danaoi, another of Homer's labels for the Greeks. Even if these identifications are all sound, and they are debated, they only go to establish that Egyptians and Hittites were aware of people from the Greek mainland and of a place possibly called Ilios or Troy. The Hittite records do not put them together to report a war on Willusa by the Ahiyawa, or indeed any major military incursion by these Westerners into Turkey. Once more, a potentially hot line of inquiry cools on closer scrutiny. It is best if we establish several ground rules in assessing all of this material. First, Homer was a poet, not an historian. Being historically accurate was not his main concern, nor that of the tradition to which he belonged. Second, the bardic epic tradition clearly magnified and glorified the events it described. And third, if there really was an historical Trojan War, it was likely a rather minor event that didn't merit notice even by the neighbouring Hittites. But for whatever reason, it acquired a towering cultural status among the Greeks, and that status is not in the least impugned by the actuality or not of the war itself. Parallels are provided by the Battle of Little Bighorn, also known as Custer's Last Stand, in America, or the Song of Roland in France. In military historical terms, these were minor engagements involving only a few hundred US cavalrymen and Frankish warriors, respectively. In artistic and cultural terms, of course, they took on quite different dimensions as cornerstones of national mythologies. While sober historical analysis can reevaluate the realities of such conflicts, their value as cultural capital stands unimpaired. This is no less the case with the Homeric poems. Their power and attraction lies not in the historicity or their lack of historicity, but in what they tell us about the human condition, the nature of duty, honor, friendship, and death. This is why people still read Homer today, almost 3,000 years after the oral tradition was first set down to papyrus. Whether any of it actually happened is, in a very real sense, quite secondary. In one respect, however, the Iliad may provide vital information for the military historian: the way early Greek warfare was fought. You will not be surprised to hear that major scholarly controversy swirls around this issue too, as various models for so-called Homeric warfare as a distinct and historical practice have been proposed and challenged. For the rest of this lecture, we turn our attention to this issue. What is discussed here lays vital groundwork for the material to be addressed in Lecture 9. Battle scenes in the Iliad are all of a type. The focus is firmly on individual heroes who are nearly always named, even if they appear only for a few lines, to get speared or hacked to death. So, typically, and I quote, "There he killed Asinus, then Hyperon, a frontline captain. One he stabbed with the bronze lance above the nipple, the other his heavy sword hacked at the collarbone, right on the shoulder, cleaving the whole shoulder clear of neck and back," unquote. The main characters fight it out in duels, which are presented as taking place in front of their respective armies. Indeed, they are often termed promachoi, which means fighters out front. The promachoi show up clad in bronze armor and use spears, swords, and stones. Usually, the fight opens with a spear cast, or occasionally a huge boulder which, as Homer has it, no two men could lift, weak as men are now. Another spear is held in reserve for closer work if the throw misses. As a last resort, the sword can be drawn. Lengthy speechifying sometimes precedes the clash, as heroes recall past encounters, taunt opponents, and vaunt their own capabilities. There is room enough in the combat zone for hurled spears or stones to miss their targets and hit open ground, for the wounded or dead to be withdrawn by groups of followers, and for heroes to advance and retreat freely. Indeed, there is enough room for chariots to patrol the field, delivering fresh fighters or picking up those who were tired out or injured. Occasionally, massed, tightly packed ranks appear, sometimes likened in similes to walls. Longer-range combat with arrows, stones, and spears is also referred to. But, really in a secondary role, since the main work of the heroes is conducted at close quarters with spear and sword. Putting it all together, Homeric battles seem to be fought by a few heavily armored men out front, between lines of larger masses of men who throw stones and fire arrows at each other. The free movement of fighters and chariots demonstrates that open cast combat is what's envisioned, spread out over a wide area. This model was the standard view up until recently, when new research has cast the whole matter back into dispute. Today, a terrific spectrum of scholarly opinion exists about how the Homeric battle scenes should be interpreted. To some, Homeric warfare is a poetic fiction, unreflective of any form of warfare that was ever actually practiced. In this view, Homeric battle is an amalgamation of features and details drawn from various phases of the epic tradition's development. Some parts would be familiar to Homer's audience, so that the scenes made sense to them. Some would be unfamiliar, to emphasize the heroic context. Homer's interest was in entertaining the audience and in exploring the human issues central to the poem's themes, not with being accurate and rigorously consistent in his portrayal of combat modes. The fact that Homer appears to be confused about some military details would tend to support this view of Homeric battle as largely fictitious. For instance, in Homer, chariots are used to move prominent men to and from the front. The vehicles have a driver and a warrior, and the warrior invariably dismounts to engage the enemy on foot, although some unfortunates are speared right out of their vehicles. In reality, as we've seen, chariots are properly used in the Bronze Age in large formations as firing platforms for javelineers or for archers. Since Homer hadn't a clue how chariot warfare was actually conducted, but since he had inherited a tradition that featured chariots, he created a fictional role for them as battlefield taxis. Likewise, bronze-clad warriors are unlikely to sprint about the way Homer's heroes do, throwing spears, dodging missiles, and chasing down fleeing enemies. Features like this suggest that Homer's warfare is a warfare of the imagination, not of reality. Others see things very differently and argue, for instance, that the mere presence of chariots on the Homeric battlefield is itself represents a memory of their one-time use in warfare, but in a manner that the bardic tradition has seriously distorted. So their presence suggests not outright fiction, but garbled memory of an erstwhile reality. Even among those who believe that Homeric warfare reflects a reality, however, there's a wide variety of opinion. Some accept that the Homeric descriptions should be read at face value and argue that the model of the promachoi, the fighters out front, operating between lines of lighter-armed, socially inferior followers, finds parallels in ethnographic records of fighting among New Guinean tribesmen or the samurai warriors of Japan. On the basis of such better documented parallels, Homeric warfare ought to be considered as an historical reality, pretty much as it is presented. But it is not exactly clear how an amalgam of loose parallels from widely diverging contexts proves the historicity of Homer's descriptions. This, to me, is a big problem with it. Parallels are at best suggestive, but they're never probative. Another view rejects the standard model of Homeric warfare altogether and stresses the passages where massed ranks appear, such as this. A wall of them bulked together, spear by spear, shield by shield, the rims overlapping, buckler to buckler, helm to helm, man to man massed tight, and the horsehair crests on glittering helmet horns brushed as they tossed their heads, the battalions bulked so dense, shoulder to shoulder close, unquote. Not much room here for the heroic dueling or for the open order combat. So massed ranked combat, it is argued, is actually decisive in Homer's battles. Since we know that later Greeks fought in tight formations of bronze-clad spearmen, proponents of this view hold that Homer refers to this later type of fighting with some embellishments for dramatic effect. Yet the duels of the promachoi are still unquestionably a major part of Homeric combat. So how do they jibe with the massed ranked passages? The answer is to propose phases in the combat. An opening exchange of missiles that leads to a fight among duelists in open order, which in turn gives way to massed combat of packed ranks. Or the massed ranks clash first, which leads to missile exchanges, and is then followed by the duels of the promachoi. The order of the phases is thus malleable. Since it was proposed in 1977, this massed ranked model of the Homeric warfare has become so popular that it is today the new standard view. The problem with the model is that the alleged phases are not nearly as distinct from one another in the poetry as their champions would have us believe. The massed ranks, for instance, only emerge occasionally and in particular circumstances, such as when a hero is in trouble and calls for support, or when a fight develops over the corpse of a fallen comrade. The massing of ranks, in other words, is not a distinct, never mind a decisive phase of Homeric battles. It is an occasional resort. This is strikingly different from the later Greek warfare the poems are supposed to reflect. In these later battles, as we shall see in Lecture 9, the armored warriors went into battle en masse in tight formation and maintained that formation through to the end. Further, there is no distinct missile phase in the Homeric poems. Rather, missiles are constantly being fired or hurled as the fighting proceeds. And let's not forget that we have these chariots roaming around. The phase model of Homeric combat, while very cleverly argued, thus relies on a selective reading of select passages and cannot be sustained after a close reading of what Homer actually describes. So yet another approach is to take as a starting point a consistent reading of all Homeric battle passages, not just bits and pieces of them. Once a judicious interpretive stance is adopted, goes this argument, battle turns out to be rather consistently represented in the poems. Homer depicts battles in a cinematic fashion. He sometimes offers a panorama or sometimes a close-up of heroes battling it out. The idea of phases fails to appreciate this poetic mode of depiction, at least goes this line of argument. The text simply moves from one plane to another as the poet's attention is drawn to a close-up or a wide-angle view. Given the legendary world of epic, there are, of course, fantastical elements on display, such as the massive gold-encrusted weapons or the direct intervention of gods into the combat or extended verbal exchanges in the heat of battle. But, goes the argument, Homer's audience would have recognized the reality of the battle scenes while simultaneously discerning the fantastical in them. A parallel might be how combat in the Star Wars movies is familiar looking to modern audiences, even as we know that the weapons and the hardware are all fairly, well, unrealistic. Once the clearly fictional elements have been stripped away, an internally consistent and not implausible form of warfare is discernible in Homer. On this view, then, Homeric warfare is reconstructed as largely open-order combat among promachoi, but massed ranks could be formed under pressure and missile exchanges were constantly going on as the fighting proceeded. Chariots were less military in function and more status symbols, as was the heavy armor worn by the main fighters. Just because Homeric Greeks did not use chariots the same way that the Egyptians or the Hittites did, does not mean Homer was clueless about how chariots performed in battle. In other words, the Greek use of the chariot seems to be at least consistent and plausible. Homeric warfare, then, on this view, is a consistent entity and probably reflects an historical form of combat. So we have several models of what Homer is describing when he describes warfare, ranging from a New Guinean samurai amalgam to a denial that there ever was such a thing in the first place. There seems little room to maneuver in this densely contested scholarly battlefield, and the continuously underlying problem of making sense of the Homeric poetry as an historical source adds immeasurably to the complexity of the debate. For what it's worth, my views are as follows. The performative nature of epic poetry seems to me a critical factor. In order for epic combat to resonate with the live audience, they must have been able to recognize what was going on. To depict a form of fighting that was completely fictitious risked losing their interest. To my mind, this is enough to establish that Homeric warfare must have a basis in historical reality. The space battles in the Star Wars films were actually modeled on footage of real World War II aerial engagements. By choreographing the movements of fantastic-looking spaceships from real combat airplanes, the familiar was embedded within the imaginary, and a bridge was built to the audience's world. So even Star Wars combat, it can be argued, is founded in some form of historical reality. I believe the same is true of Homeric warfare. Figuring out what that reality might have been is far more difficult. I favor the view that, once stripped of the clearly fantastical elements, Homeric battle scenes are internally consistent. I see no reason why the open-order warfare found in Homer was not the norm in the 8th century and earlier. In vase paintings from this very era, from the Dipylon Cemetery in Athens, we see in geometric silhouette warriors armed with large shields, crested helmets, two spears and swords. Some even climb off the back of chariots driven by a comrade. The echoes of Homeric warfare in these scenes are striking, although it cannot be ruled out that the images are in fact inspired by the epic tradition itself. But in my more romantic moments, and there are few and far between, I like to think of the influence running in the opposite direction. I imagine a group of these Dipylon warriors, as the vase-painted fighters have been dubbed, gathered around a hearth, spellbound by a bard singing about fighting heroes before the walls of Troy, and then going out to take part in battles fought in a fashion very close to that enshrined in the verses, still ringing in their ears. I'd like to end on a slightly different note and address the issue of violence in the Homeric poems. Homer's Iliad is replete with gruesome images of violent death, so much so that even my modern students are sometimes appalled by it. People get stabbed through the face, the spear points severing their tongues as it explodes out the backs of their heads. Their limbs are cleaved from their bodies, blood spurts and gushes and pours, screams pierce the air, and the dying writhe in the dust and claw the earth. This aspect of warfare must have been familiar to any Greek or indeed any military audience in any era. The dead and the mutilated are the constants of warfare in all ages. But a particular feature of this brutal violence is emphasized in Homer, which raises his poetry to its well-deserved level of classic. The consequences are unsparingly presented. Minor characters show up to be straightaway gored by a spear, but they're often given a personal history. For example, in Book 4, a Trojan called Simoisius appears for less than a dozen lines, but listen to how he is presented. And Telamonian Ajax struck Anthemian's son, the hardy stripling Simoisius, still unwed. His mother had borne him along the Simoisius' banks when she trailed her parents down the slopes of Ida to tend their flocks, so they called him Simoisius. But never would he repay his loving parents now for the gift of rearing, his life cut short so soon, brought down by the spear of lion-hearted Ajax. At the first charge, he slashed his right nipple. Clear through the shoulder went the brazen point, and down in the dust he fell. And here are Homer's lines about a pair of Trojan brothers slaughtered by Diomedes, son of Tydeus, in a single encounter. The son of Tydeus killed the two of them on the spot and ripped the dear life out of both and left their father tears and wrenching grief. Now he'd never welcome his two sons home from war, alive and in the flesh, and distant kin would carve apart their birthright. Homer's attitude towards war is therefore deeply ambiguous. He recognizes the glory and courage and the opportunities of the battlefield, but the tragedy of young people dying in combat is not lost on him. Everyone has a mother, a father, wives and kids at home. Each killing ripples across the pool of human misery. It is well to remember with Homer that the brutality of war has deeply personal consequences.